Beruchim Abayim, ladies. We are studying Parashat Kedoshim. The beginning of our Parashat Vidaber Adonai Moshe Lemor. God speaks to Moshe and says, Daber El Kol Adat Bnei Yisrael. Speak to the entire assembly of the children of Israel. V'amarta Alehim, and tell them, and say to them, Kedoshim Tehiyu. You shall be holy. Ki Kadosh Ani Adonai Elohechem. Because I am God who is holy. Now, this is a positive commandment from the Torah. We might not think of it in those terms, but the Torah is commanding every single Jew that they must be holy. It's an amazing commandment. We understand that Kiddusha, holiness, is usually limited to the great rabbis in Jerusalem, or the great tzaddikim living in Bnei Berak, or the 36 hidden tzaddikim that are in the world. Those people are holy. But to demand from every single Jew, the entire assembly, that you must be kadosh. Everybody has to be holy. So the question is, how does one become holy? Does that mean that they must go to the mikveh every day and purify themselves? Well, I'm sure that might be a good way to add kiddusha to a person. But what is the essence? From where does a person bring holiness in his life? Actually, Rashi, in his first comment on the parasha, tells us where the secret of holiness may be found. And he writes, Kedoshim tehiyu hevu perushim min arayot. A person must be removed from arayot. What are arayot? Arayot are sins of immorality, sins of immodesty. Rashi says sins of adultery and sins of forbidden relations, sins of incest, sins of women that are impure, and these type of avonot. From here we see, ladies, that kiddusha can only be found in a place where there are fences made up to protect the modesty and the purity of our people. We are living in a time that, unfortunately, there is the antithesis of kiddusha all over the world. Wherever we walk, wherever we look, wherever we listen, we hear immorality. That has become the national pastime of this country, of the world. There's nothing on television today that is modest, nor in the newspapers or in the magazines. And therefore, how do we expect in such a generation to fulfill this commandment? Rashi then tells us, Kol makom she'ata motze geder shel erva, ata motze kedusha. Wherever you find restriction of sexual immorality, you find holiness. And therefore, one must know that whenever our rabbis go out and are strict when it comes to the laws of modesty, and the listener might say, why are they exaggerating? Why are they going to such an extreme? Why are they building such fences? Why don't they be a little more tolerant when it comes to such behavior? A few years ago, there was an epidemic in our community. I don't know if the epidemic still exists, of community organizations that were hosting co-ed exercise classes. Not only co-ed exercise classes, but even exercise classes with a man teaching a woman. And of course, the woman got all upset. How can the rabbis tell us such a thing? What is it, their business? What are they getting involved for? It's a class. We're going to exercise. Why does everything have to be right away concocted to the lowest common denominator? And the Shem Shamayim, we're going to do these things for health reasons. Now the rabbis want to put such restrictions. Our rabbis didn't make this up. It's coming from this pasuk. How do we expect our Jewish community to remain holy if we allow ourselves to break a fence and breach the wall? Is that a modest behavior that a man should be teaching a lady that is not dressed? Actually, she is dressed properly for exercise. That is the clothes of exercise. But that a man should be teaching such a thing, Well, we think that all our all the teachers that are teaching are tzaddikim and hasidim. The Gemara says nobody can be trusted. Or the most of these people, are they righteous? Are they pious people? Are they those that study all day long, that we have so much faith in them, that their soul is Shem Shamayim and just giving a class and receiving their payment? Read what it says in the magazines. Read what it says in the newspapers about the industry of training and all the problems that have come out. Ask your friends what's happening in our community today of marriages that have been shattered because of behavior like this. And therefore, again, Kiddusha, holiness, can only be found where there's fences made in regard to immorality. And these things are intolerable. These things are, Chas v'Shalom, destructive to the framework and to the foundations of a community. And therefore, we can never be too extreme. Of course, certain things, it's not good to be extreme. But when it comes to these things, whenever you reach the level of extremity, go two steps further and make offense on offense on offense. For those of you that have children, how careful do we have to be to the magazines that we allow into our homes? Our children are pure. Our children are going to the yeshivot. They're studying Torah. They have holy souls. And then a child comes home and now sees a magazine that has in it things that are not proper, pictures that are not proper, and they pick it up innocently. They don't have any malicious intent. And all of a sudden, avera goreret avera, and their souls become tainted. And all the kiddusha that we're trying to instill in our children can become undone because of something that they see. It's enough what they see in the street. It's enough what they see on the billboards. It's enough what they see on the newsstands. But to bring these things into our homes, this is a terrible breach in the Kiddusha of Beit Yisrael, in the Kiddusha of the Jewish home. And this is a commandment. Tevu perushim in arayot. We must abstain ourselves from all figures and forms of immorality. Then we have a holy nation. The next pasuk. Ish imo ve'aviv tira'u. Torah tells us that a person must fear his father and his mother. Torah is teaching us the law of kibud av va'em, just in a different form. Here it's telling us that the children not only have to honor their parents, but they must fear their parents. So I saw from one of the rabbis, what's the connection between kiddushin, to be holy, and fearing parents? So one of the rabbis said, this might be hinting to us one of the great episodes that happened in our Torah with Yosef HaSadiq. Yosef, the righteous man, he was sent down to Egypt as a young man. He was sold down to Egypt as a young man. He was 17 years old, and he was a very handsome man. And he worked for a fellow called Potiphar. And Potiphar's wife every day tried to seduce Yosef in order to commit a sin of immorality. And she almost wore him down. And every day she would entice him and try to lure Yosef. Ladies, you have to imagine what type of difficult test this was for Yosef. I mean, he was all alone. He was living without his family, without his parents, without his brothers or sisters. There was no community in Egypt. Yosef was the only Jew in the whole country. What stopped Yosef from committing this act of immorality? Where did he gain the strength to control himself? If he would have succumbed to his desire, who would have known? There would have been no recourse. What was the only thing that stopped Yosef from committing this sin? And the Torah tells us that at the moment of passion, all of a sudden he saw in his mind the image of his father. He saw Yaakov Abinu, Demu diyukno shel Abiv nir'ah elav. He saw Yaakov Abinu's image imprinted in his brain. And at that moment, he started to shake. And he said to himself, I'm a son of Yaakov Avinu. For my father's respect, for my father's dignity, how can I succumb to such a passion, such a base desire? This is not kavod for my father, even if I'm willing to forget about my own career. But this is a stain on my father's reputation. And therefore, the Torah is telling us, Kiddushim tiyu. we must become holy. Ish imo ve'aviv tira'u. Because when the parents are holy, then the children become holy. Because when our children are about to commit sin, they think about their parents. They say, oh, my parents worked so hard on educating me. They sacrificed so much in order to provide me a proper lifestyle and a pure environment. Now I'm going to make such a sin. And therefore there is a connection. Kedoshim tihiyu. Ish imo ve'aviv tira'u. Just like Yosef feared his father and that protected him from committing a sin of immorality, we must be the same parents to our children. That when our children think of us in their mind, they'll say, oh, that's unacceptable to my mother and father. My parents would never tolerate such behavior, and therefore that will refrain them. But if our children have an impression of us that we're carefree, that we're loose, and that we allow ourselves to involve ourselves in promiscuity, God forbid, and these type of behaviors, then what's going to happen? Our children are going to think of their parents and say, oh, my father and mother would do the same thing. And therefore, there'll be no restraint. There'll be no fear factor that our children will have. I think the second pasuke that we quoted, Ish imo ve'aviv tira'u, can be explained in a different light. Literally it means ish, a person, imo ve'aviv tira'u, should fear his mother and father. Ish is a person, a man, should fear his mother and his father. But I saw from one of the rabbis called the Siftei Kohen, he explained the pasuk as follows, and he said, ish, your children are going to grow up to become an ish. Our children are young now, but in a short amount of time, all of a sudden they become mature individuals. And before we know it, they themselves become parents. And then all of a sudden, we look and say, what happened? Their childhood went by so quickly, we didn't educate them the right way, we didn't teach them, we squandered all those precious moments. Now they're away from us, now they're on their own. And therefore the Torah warns us, ish, your children are going to become an ish. Remember that. They're young now. 7-year-old child. A father says, oh, he's going to be 7 years old forever. And the difference between 7 and 8 is not that much greater. And between 7 and 9 is also not that much a difference. But all of a sudden, the child becomes bar mitzvah. You say, I don't believe it. He was just 7 years old. And then 5 years later, already he's off. And he's looking to get married. And therefore, the Torah warns the parents, your children are going to become ish. And therefore, who should be scared? Ish imo ve'aviv tira'u. The parent should be scared. The parent should be frightened because of this maturity of the children. And that fear of the parent should cause them to spring into action and educate the child. Don't lose the child when he's young. Don't think, the child, Lexi here will teach him. He's still young, we don't have to educate him. Before you know it, he'll be an ish. And therefore, since children grow up very quickly, imo ve'aviv tira'u, the parents have to be scared. The parents have to be constantly worried that they're maybe not doing enough to give their children the proper chinuch. On this pasuk, kedoshim tihiyu, I think there's another lesson that can be learned. The lesson is that we have in it in our ability to become holy. Look how much God believes in us. Look how much faith God has in His children. That He's talking to all of us and saying, you can be holy yourself. We might not think of it ourselves that way. Me, holy? Like I said at the beginning, it's not for me this pasuk. But Torah is telling everybody, you can be holy. There was once a speaker that got up in front of 200 people. And the speaker took out a $100 bill and waved the $100 bill in front of everybody and said, who wants this $100 bill? And everybody raised their hand, of course, giving out a $100 bill. I'll take it. And then the speaker said, 1 second. And he took the $100 bill and he crumbled it up. He crumbled it up as small as he could crumble it. And then he opened it again and now it was all wrinkled. And he turned to everybody and said, who wants this $100 bill? And everybody still raised their hand. So what? And then the speaker said, wait, I'm not finished. And he took the $100 bill and put it on the floor and he started to step on it and it started to make it all dirty. And now he picked it up off the floor with his fingers like this, a dirty $100 bill. And said, who wants a $100 bill now? And 200 people raised their hand. And then the speaker went on to teach a lesson to those students and said that no matter how soiled or how crumbled or how dirty a $100 bill becomes, it doesn't decrease in value. The value of a $100 bill is a $100 bill no matter what happens. And then he turned to the students and said, that is the value of every single human being. Even though we go through life and sometimes we feel worthless because of mistakes that we made in our lives, or bad decisions that we made from time to time, or circumstances that presented themselves to us and we didn't deal properly, and then we feel to ourselves, we have no value anymore, and we fall into a depression and despondency, and we say, I'm good, what am I? I'm nothing, I have no value. A dirty $100 bill still has value. And a Jew and a human being that has made mistakes and has soiled himself and has committed sins, he still has the same value of his holy neshama. And therefore everybody must remember, yes, you too, kedoshim tiyu, you too could be holy. And nobody should be bogged down by their past and say, well, if only the people would know what I did and where I came from. On the contrary, the Gemara Berachot says, "Bimkom shebaale teshuvah omdim, en tzadikim gemurim yicholim la'amod." In the place where people who made teshuvah stand, even the greatest, most righteous people cannot stand in that place. Such a value of those people that came from a different world and then repented and joined the Torah world, their value is even greater than the tzaddikim. Why? Because they tasted a different life. And for them to overcome that, that's a much greater test than maybe to be sheltered and never to be exposed. I had a great rabbi, Hacham Yosef Hamway, alav shalom. Joe Hamway, alav shalom. He taught us many, many important lessons in life. And once when visiting him on Sukkot, he told us the following example. He said the king once called three of his people and he asked them to please take a jar of royal jelly. They asked him, what is royal jelly? He said, oh, this was made by the greatest chefs of the world. It's the most tasty jelly, the most delectable item. And it's sealed in a jar. And please, I ask you, I'm giving it to you for 30 days. Return it to me after 30 days with the seal on it. You cannot eat it. And whoever returns it to me closed will get reward. So they went, they took it. The first fellow kept on looking at it and said, I wonder how tasty this jelly is. If the king is telling to me, the best chefs in the world, I just like to taste a little of it. He won't know the difference if I just take a little off the top. The king won't tell him anything missing. So he started to eat it. And in truth, it was the most tasty thing he ever had. And he couldn't control himself. And he ate it a little more, and he ate it a little more. And then he looked at it, it was halfway done already. He said, it's too late, the king's going to realize already. So I might as well finish it. So he finished the entire jar, and then he sealed it. Other fellow, he said, I don't want to be tested, I don't want to be tempted. And he took the jelly the second he got it, and he put it in his vault, and he locked the vault, and he threw away the key. It's finished. If the king wants it, we'll have to blow up the vault to give it back to him. But I'm not eating it. Another fellow looked at it and said, I have to taste it. And he started to eat a little of it. And he started to eat a little more of it. And in the middle of his eating, he said to himself, what am I doing? I can't control myself. I have the greatest passion to finish this. But the king told me, don't eat it. And therefore he closed it and he put it back. Now 30 days passed. And the first fellow comes and he shows the king an empty jar. And the king says, you couldn't control yourself. And of course, you do not get reward, and the king imprisoned him and put him in jail. The second fellow comes along and shows him complete jar. He brought him his vault. They opened it up. Complete jar. The king says, wow, what self-control you have. 100,000 rubles you get for your self-control. And then the third fellow, a little embarrassed, a little shy, shows the king his jar. And the king says, half-filled. To you get 200,000 rubles. And the first fellow says, what do you mean, 200? I didn't eat anything. He gets 200,000. He said, you never tasted the royal jelly. You took it, you threw it in the vault, you locked it up. Maybe it was easy for you. He tasted it, and he still controlled himself, and he stopped. That's a true person, that's a true man. He overcame the test. And that's the same thing Hachem Yosef, Hamwe Alevajo told us about Ba'alei Teshuvah. Ba'alei Teshuvah came from a different world. They tasted all the pleasures. They traveled, they ate, they went, they saw. And now all of a sudden, to leave all that, and to come and live a life of Torah, for them it's a little more difficult. For them, there's an extra test because they tasted the jelly, and then they sealed the jar, and they put it away. And therefore, the Torah is telling you, yes, you could be kadosh as well. Kedoshim to you, be holy. Don't worry what you did in the past. A dirty $100 bill is still worth $100. And therefore, you can still redeem yourself. And therefore, you can still attain greatness. Our Torah continues. One of the laws in the Torah in this week's parasha, there's many mitzvot. One of the mitzvot is lo ta'ashok et re'acha. Torah says that we're not allowed to cheat our friends. What does it mean, cheat our friends? Rashi understands this pasuk, that if we owe our friends money, we must pay them immediately. We must not hold money that does not belong to us, even though we admit, yes, we owe them, but we'll give it to them next week. Because we want to hold on to the money a little longer before we have to pay. Torah says that's considered cheating. That's considered robbery. If you owe somebody money, lo ta'ashok et re'acha. Don't cheat him. The money belongs to him. And the Sefer HaHanuk says that's a corruptive nature. That somebody owes somebody money. Somebody owes something to somebody else and doesn't pay them. When they have the money, of course, we're talking about. And even if they don't have the money, they have to see to it to make sure that the money is paid anyhow. That somehow they get either a reprieve or they borrow the money to pay it off. Otherwise, it's considered lo ta'ashok. The question is, why does it say lo ta'ashok et re'acha? It says, do not cheat your friend. Why in this case do we call the fellow his friend? I mean, he's cheating him. Do people cheat their friends? So the explanation is, because that's what people rationalize. They say, that's my friend, so if I don't pay him this week, it's okay, he doesn't care. That's why people think they get away from paying their debts. They say, oh, re'acha, he's my friend. You think he's going to care if I don't pay him the money immediately? And the Torah is telling you, even if he's your friend, you owe him the money, you must pay. Then the Torah tells us, lo talin pe'ulat sakhir. Just like we have to pay our friends back money that we borrowed from them and that they gave us, or money that belongs to them, we must pay our workers on time. If somebody does a job for us, we must immediately pay them for the job that they did. There's a story recently told of a lady that had a maid in the house. And it was before the holiday. And she decided that she's not going to pay the maid what's due to her from a week before the holiday. She decided she'll pay the wages a week after the holiday. It seems that you understand the rationale. This is why, for some reason, this I don't have to explain to anybody. And she explained, of course, what you're laughing about. She said, if I pay her before the holiday, she'll leave. But now that I owe her money, so now she can't go anywhere. And therefore, the maid will have to stay until after the holiday to get paid. So when she told this to her rabbi, the rabbi said, Lo talin pe'ulat sakhir. The Torah says, do not delay paying workers that did work for you. You're more scared of a maid leaving you than God leaving you. God's giving you a commandment, you have to pay the workers. That you have more fear of your health than you have of the law of God. And therefore the Torah tells us, we must be very honest when dealing with our workers, and we must give them the proper payment. There are so many stories told, countless stories told about the great Hachamim, how honest they were when it came to dealing with other people's money, with money that did not belong to them. I recently read a story of one of the great rabbis of Bnei Berak that had passed on. And the first day of the 7 days of mourning, he appeared to his granddaughter in a dream. And he told her, very, very mysteriously, what's going to be with the belts? What's going to be with the belts? What is he talking about? So she woke up, she discarded the dream, and he came back and said, what's going to be with the belts? And this man was a very honest man. So honest, they tell a story about him that one time, he was getting on a bus, and he gave the bus driver some money to ride the bus, and the guy gave him a couple of extra coins as change. He didn't realize till he got off the bus. So he stood at the bus stop until that bus driver made his route again all the way back to that same spot. And then he got to who knows how many hours till that bus driver had to make his whole route. And he got on again and said, I was waiting for you. Here's the money back. And the bus driver went crazy. What an honest man. For a few quarters, he stood like that. Anyway, this rabbi came to his granddaughter and said, what's going to be with the belts? And they knew he was such an honest man. So they went into his closet and they're looking at his belts. So anything wrong? Nothing wrong. They couldn't figure it out. So they went to his wife. And they said, this is the story. Your husband came to us. The belts. What could it be? And they're breaking their heads. And finally they came to the conclusion. They said, when he was getting older, this rabbi, he started to lose weight. He was sick. So they took all his belts to the tailor of the town, and they asked him if he could make holes in the belt in order that his pants, you know, they can shorten the belt for him. So, a very simple job. He took his wool, and he made the hole in his pants. So when they wanted to pay him, he said, well, I'm going to charge you for making a hole in the belt. Leave it. It's my zechut for the rabbi. So the rabbi came back in a dream and said, this man over here did work for us. He didn't do one belt. If you go to a tailor, they charge you for this over here. He told you he doesn't want to charge you. But if it was somebody else, he would charge them. And therefore, I don't know if he did it 100% from his heart. Maybe in his heart, really, he wants to charge for his services. Therefore, he says, what's going to be with the belt? So they went back to the guy and said, here, my father came to the gym. Here's the money. I don't want to take it. Take the money, please. And he took the money, of course. And then they found out that really this man did charge for such a service. But in this case, he was embarrassed. To show you how careful you have to be. I'm not one to tell too many personal stories. But to bring out a point, I will tell you a story that happened a few years back. I had taught some Torah classes in one of the community synagogues, to be unnamed. It was actually this time of year, during the Sefirat HaOmer. It was a series of like 6 or 7 classes. And I had made up with the committee of that synagogue the remunerations that they'll pay me for my services. And it was very amicable, everything was fine. But it seems that after the series was over, the summer came right away, so I had forgotten about it. And they had forgotten about it, and we each one went their own way. Then when we came back in September, I thought to myself, I said, I don't know if I ever got paid, let me go check it, and then, we'll get back to you, and this and that, and it dragged on. So a year later, there was a fellow that used to work in our synagogue over here. Alav Shalom, Mr. Isaac Paz. He was the accountant of the synagogue. And he also worked on the committee of that synagogue. So I once saw him, I said, Isaac, very strange. I worked in the synagogue a year ago, and they never paid me. Maybe it was an oversight, and he got all embarrassed. He said, what? A year ago, you worked in the synagogue? I remember, I attended those classes. He said, what kind of business is this? I said, oh, maybe the synagogue doesn't have money. It doesn't have money. They have money enough. Even if they don't have money, they have to pay you. So I got embarrassed out of his reaction. So he took out money from his pocket. I said, no, Isaac, I didn't come to take it from your house. I didn't know if you know you're on the committee. I'm just talking to you. So he says, no. He says, I'm not paying from my pocket. He says, I'll go back to the committee and get the money. But in the meantime, so he took out half the money. If they owed me $1,000, he took out $500 from his pocket. He says, I will get you the other $500. I said, wow, Isaac, I'm sorry. I didn't want you to take it. No, don't worry. He says, I'll get it from them. They're paying you. I'm not paying you. I said, fine. He wouldn't take no. So now, a few months later, this fellow had passed away. So, of course, it was an untimely tragedy. A few weeks after that, one of the members of that committee came to my office right here down the hall in the synagogue with an envelope. So I said, what is this? They said, this is the money that we owe you. He says, Rabbi, we have a story to tell you. Last night, he said, he came to me on Sunday, so it was on Friday night. He said, Friday night, my wife woke up in the middle of the night, and she woke me up, and she said, Isaac Paz came to me in a dream, and said, pay the rabbi, you owe the rabbi $500, give him his money. So my wife said, well, what is it, what kind of dream is this? So she went back to sleep, and then it happened again. So she woke up and says, do you owe the rabbi any money? And he says, oh, he's right, he told me before he passed away that he gave 500, or he owes him 500. They said, Hakam, we're sorry. So here you see how careful in Shamayim there is when it comes to paying people the money. We don't have to wait for people to come back in dreams, and we don't have to wait for Gilgulim and all these scare tactics. If a person owes somebody money, you're supposed to pay him on time. You're not supposed to delay it, especially donations to synagogues, where so many people make nedavot during the holidays, and everybody gets up $1,000, $10,000, and then the community or the synagogue has a difficult time collecting. It's very easy to donate, but it's not as easy to pay. And therefore, one should never have outstanding pledges. The moment he makes a pledge, he should write the check out, like we said many times, to pay it so he doesn't have to owe anybody anything. The Torah then tells us in the Perasha, V'chi yagur itecha ger be'artzechem lo tonu oto. The Torah tells us that we must be very, very kind to a ger. What is a ger? A ger is a convert. The Torah tells us, lo tonu oto, we're not allowed to taunt the converts. What does it mean to taunt a convert? To say to him, no, I remember when you used to worship idolatry. You used to be a goy, used to be a Gentile. Now all of a sudden you became Jewish. Now you think you're something special. Chas v'shalom, you're not allowed to taunt any Jew. But the Torah goes out of its way to teach us how careful we have to be to maintain the dignity of the convert, especially because already he feels like an outsider. And therefore, it says, "V'ahavtem et ager," you must love him. The Rambam, in one of the most famous letters that he wrote to an Arab convert by the name of Obadiah, this fellow, Obadiah, the convert, sent the Rambam a letter 1,000 years ago. And he said that he was having a discussion with his rabbi, and they were discussing the religion of Islam. So the convert, Obadiah, told his rabbi, I don't think Islam is considered Avodah Zarah. It's not idolatry because they do believe in God. It might not be the right rituals and the right religion, of course, but it's not considered idolatry. Idolatry is when you worship a table, when you worship a figurine. So the rabbi told this Obadiah, you don't know what you're talking about. It's Avodah Zarah, and you're a fool for saying such a thing. And the rabbi got angry at him and called him all sorts of names. So Obadiah sent a letter to Harambam and said, this is the story that happened. Who's right? He says, first of all, in all due respect to your rabbi, but he's wrong in this case. Islam, they believe in God. It's not considered idolatry per se. But what's more perturbing to me, which is more disturbing to me, is the reaction of your rabbi. He says, our Torah says 36 times how careful we have to be when dealing with a convert. And here your rabbi calls you a fool. So I want to ask you a question. Can a convert be a fool? On the contrary, the convert was involved in a foreign religion, and then he saw the truth of Judaism. That is no fool. Your rabbi must fast and cry and ask forgiveness from you and from God in order that he should be forgiven. This law of loving the convert is maybe not so applicable or accessible for members of our community. Many years back, our great master and leader, Hacham Yaakov Katzin Zichrono Levracha, the great sage and visionary, enacted a decree, an edict that was universally accepted by all the communities within our community and all the synagogues of our community, not to accept converts. Now, of course, the rabbi did not mean to say that people cannot convert. It's not up to any rabbi to decide what the Torah says is permissible. All he said is that in this community, that they are not going to accept them to marry into our people, to accept them to the yeshivot, to pray with us in our synagogues. But the rabbi had a very, very strong, compelling argument. His argument was because today, a lot of the conversions are not done l'shem shamayim. A lot of the conversions are done half-heartedly or for intention just to marry. And therefore the rabbi said, what can happen in our community? We'll have all goyim that are going to want to marry into our people. And they'll go, they'll jump into the mikveh, they'll tell the rabbi, yeah, we want to be Jewish. And they'll, you know, learn a couple of the laws. And then right after they get married, then already they'll revert back to their old ways. And now all of a sudden we're going to have infiltration of quasi-Jews in our community, and it'll destroy the entire purity and the genealogy of our people. It saved our community, because any community that did not make this edict, look around today in the communities around the world, even the Sephardi communities, they lost. When I was in Mexico, when I was in Panama, we were sitting in the minyan, and the fellow that I was with told me, Hakam, this person over here, he's wearing a yarmulke praying mincha, married Goya, and this one a convert, but really it's a fake convert, and this one married a convert, and that one, and the whole community becomes intermingled and becomes mixed, and we don't know who's pure and who's not pure. So it saved our community without a doubt. Not to say that there are real converts. There are today real converts in the world today. I came in contact with one. In this synagogue here, many years ago, there used to be I call him a shamosh, but he was the caretaker, really, of the synagogue. His name was Brian. Brian was, of course, not Jewish. He was like the Shabbat goy of the synagogue. He was from the islands. He was from Trinidad. Very nice fellow. Beautiful fellow. Very, very charming. Very nice. Derech Eretz. And before we used to give our Seudat Shlishit Shi'ur downstairs in the hall over here, we used to deliver it upstairs. It was a small event. If we got 50 people, it was a tremendous accomplishment. And we used to have it over Seudat Shlishit, of course. And Brian would sit in the Seudat Shlishit, and he would have to wait till we finish so he can clean up the table. So we thought he was sitting there just because, you know, he can't wait for us to end it so he can clean up and go home. And this happened for many years. This was the ritual every Shabbat. And then Brian left the synagogue. He went to college, he went to school, whatever he was doing, and we didn't see him. Last year, I was invited to Miami Beach, to one of the synagogues there, to deliver a derasha before the high holidays. And I walked into the synagogue there in Miami Beach, and sure enough, who was sitting in the kahal? Brian! Brian from Trinidad. So, with a yarmulke on. So I said to myself, Brian, what are you doing over here? He said, I converted. He says, my children are in yeshiva. I said, you converted? How did you convert? What happened to you? He said, all those classes that I went to, Seudat Shlishit, all those Devrei Torah, all those Hidushim, it had to be true what you're saying. I said, this is the truth. I said to them, we have more success with the people from Trinidad than we have in our community. In any event, you see over here that there's true converts. This man was L'Shem Shamayim. So I said, so why did you leave Brooklyn? He says, because I know you don't accept converts in your community. So I had to move to Miami. Over here they accept me. I'm able to marry, which is right. That's the proper thing. And that's what then he moved there, he's living happily ever after. It's a tremendous story. It's a tremendous story to show that there are true people in the world, and therefore we have to bend over backwards to treat them with very, very, very great sensitivity and great love. However, there is a corollary to this Devrei Torah. While we might not have too many converts in our midst, but as I started this shiur, we do have a form of convert. And that's the Baal Teshuvah that we started to talk about in the beginning of the shiur. Those people that are coming back to their roots, those people that were Jewish from birth, but were not affiliated so much. And now that they're coming back and they're becoming more religious, so they also have a tremendous, tremendous test. Many of them have opposition from their families, opposition from their spouses, opposition from their friends. A lot of them sacrificed opportunities and careers in order to pursue a religious life. These people saw the emptiness of society. They saw that the society around them is just filled with materialism, with greed, with money, devoid of all value. And therefore they made a decision to come back to a Torah lifestyle. We must treat the Baal Teshuvah, both the male and female Baal Teshuvah, like we treat the Ger. They're our version of converts. And therefore you must treat them extra sensitive. Not to taunt them, God forbid, and say, oh, now you're born again. Now you started to get religious. Now you think you're somebody special. Now you put on a skirt. Now you think you're all of a sudden Rebbetzin. These people made tremendous sacrifices. Nobody's perfect. Not the tzaddik and not the Baal Teshuvah. Everybody has their idiosyncrasies and everybody has their issues to correct. But we have to go out of our way to make their life a little more comfortable, to make the bumps in their road a little more smoother, because they have made the ultimate sacrifice, a change of lifestyle. And instead of taunting them and pressuring them and dissuading them and trying to talk them out of their new decisions of becoming religious, the contrary, we must embrace them. Va'ahavtem et ager. We must love the convert. And in this case, we must love and respect and endear those people that have made the life-changing decision to reattach themselves to our religion and the performance of the Torah and the mitzvot. So there is really an application of loving the gerim in our community. These are our version of gerim. They're Jewish. They started Jewish and they converted back to Judaism because of their little interruption that they had in the beginning of their life. These are some of the lessons that we can learn from our parasha.